When you drive a vehicle so reliable it's backed by a 10-year, 100,000-mile limited warranty, you stop thinking about what you can't do and start doing what you never thought possible. Visit your local Kia dealer today to see what you're capable of in a vehicle that inspires confidence around every corner. Kia. Movement that inspires.
Call 800-333-4KIA for details. Always drive safely. Limited inventory available. Warranties include 10-year, 100,000-mile powertrain and 5-year, 60,000-mile basic. Warranties are limited. See retailer for details.
Hello, all you positive heads out there. Thanks for tuning your beautiful brainwaves into another episode of the Positive Head Podcast, which I'm excited to say we are now airing 5 days a week. Once a week, you can still hear an interview with a different consciousness changemaker that is out there working tirelessly to help catalyze change and expand awareness across Spaceship Earth. But now, also, in addition to the weekly interview, on the other 4 weekdays, you can tune in to myself and my co-host, Dalian, giving interpretations of our favorite thought-provoking quotes, sharing a bit of inspiring or mysterious news, taking questions from the audience, and digging into any other mind-expansive topics we deem worthy of discussion. All right, all you positive heads, on this week's interview episode, I am very happy to have teacher and author Barbara Emrys here with me. Barbara describes her teaching as using knowledge to transcend knowledge and letting go of the personal and collective stories that keep us from seeing life as it is. She most recently co-authored the book, The Toltec Art of Life and Death, which she wrote in collaboration with New York Times bestselling author of The Four Agreements, Don Miguel Ruiz. Hello, Barbara. Welcome to the show.
Hello. It's so nice to be with you today.
Oh, it's so nice to have you. I've been looking forward to this for quite some time, and having recently finished the book, it's such a wonderful experience to be able to complete a book, enjoy it so thoroughly, and then say, okay, great, I have questions, and be able to hop on and do this and, you know, pick your brain directly about the book. I have to pinch myself because that's a great feeling and experience.
Okay, good.
So you've written several books that people can find on Amazon or on your website, which is your name, BarbaraEmrys.com. And that's BarbaraEmrys.com. And we'll let them go check those out. We've got a lot to talk about with this new book. So we're going to focus on your most recent here. And of course, writing it, co-authoring along with Don Miguel Ruiz, which I'm sure many of our listeners are familiar with. If the name doesn't ring a bell, maybe the book does, The Four Agreements. It was a New York Times bestseller for what, over 7 years, right? With millions and millions of copies sold in the U.S. alone. Just out of the gate, how did you come to collaborate with Don? What an exciting thing that must have been.
Oh, well, we met over 20 years ago. I was looking for some help, and somebody suggested an interesting Mexican shaman they had met and heard speak recently, and invited me to come and listen to him speak. And that's what I did, and I was intrigued. I'm not sure I understood much of what he said, and it wasn't because of his accent or anything. It was because of the newness of the ideas and even the logic. You know, we get so stuck in our logic and we can't really see beyond that. We think we're very open-minded people, but we have so many little rules and structures that we're not even aware of ourselves. So he was sort of challenging those structures, and I began an apprenticeship with him not long after that, and that was our the beginning of our long-term relationship, from apprentice to friend to co-worker to teacher to co-author, and our relationship just keeps evolving, and we're at the point now, and have been for a while, where we just sort of think each other's thoughts, and that makes it a very valuable creative cooperation, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. So you went through shamanic training with Don.
Yes, I did. Back when Miguel was a shaman, or called himself a shaman. Actually, he was a very, very effective and powerful, I think, personal power. in his shamanic teaching. But at some point he realized that was stirring up a little too much fanaticism, and he just shifted point of view entirely. And with the publication of the Four Agreements, he became sort of a teacher and writer of logic and what it is to not only know your mind and change your mind and transform your ways of thinking, but to know yourself as the mind.
Very interesting. Now, you know, of course, the word shaman is thrown around a lot. And I've, you know, had people on the show and where we've actually covered such things as, you know, ayahuasca ceremony and things like that. And so I'm curious, when you say shamanic training, like what would the explanation of, you know, what does that mean in Don's case or in your case as someone who trained under him?
Well, typically, and I think just to be factual, a shaman is a teacher. You can add healer and guide. But in the case of Miguel Ruiz, he was all those things. He didn't want to be really known as a healer, although he did a lot of studying with his mother, who was a very well-known healer, simply because that once again stirs up, you know, a little fanaticism. So, he put his attentions to the human mind, what makes it work, and most of his training, done in the context of Toltec wisdom, was about finding out what, you know, what happens, how people respond, and how they interact with not only their life, their reality, but with words themselves and suggestions. And in the course of, you know, many years, he was able to determine how the mind worked, but more importantly, how the mind could reflect on itself and make some really important transformations.
Very fascinating. And of course, you know, the Four Agreements, just to kind of run those off, because they're such a staple of his work, you know, and for those who haven't read the Four Agreements, I highly recommend that as well. Be impeccable with your word. Don't take anything personally. Don't make assumptions, and always do your best. So just to kind of put that out there so people have an idea of what that teaching that he sort of evolved into, you know, that's really where he got started getting his recognition, right?
Well, those were the basic principles he wanted to communicate after, you know, years of working with students. And in that was also a fifth agreement that he didn't really feel the world was ready for, about skepticism. But mostly the way we heard it at the time was, don't believe yourself or anybody else. And that challenged, you know, that forced everybody to look inward and decide, well, am I going to, I think I can understand how everybody else is sort of speaking from their own point of view and their own reality, but can I actually see that regarding my reality and the opinions and beliefs I hold? Can I take them, you know, with a grain of salt?
Right. Yeah. And I think that's a very powerful idea. Right. And it's something that I often say, of course, you know, with this show, I do a lot of talking, because 4 out of the 5 days a week, it's not doing an interview. It's me and my co-host talking about various things. And I use that fifth agreement all the time. Well, don't believe anything I say. Just be open enough to explore some of these concepts and go find the truth, your own truth. You know,
and that's a very fair way of teaching. You're not trying to sell anything or change anybody's mind. The best result of doing this teaching has been that I'm not so swayed or persuaded by my own thoughts and my beliefs. I understand that I'm using them in order to communicate, but, you know, they don't own me. They don't hold authority over me or necessarily make decisions for me.
Absolutely. Yeah, I saw a quote very recently that said something that I thought was pretty powerful, of to the effect of, you know, everything we hear is an opinion, not a fact. Everything we see is a perspective, not the truth.
Exactly.
And that's Marcus Aurelius, you know. So
exactly.
I think that goes very well with it.
That point of view has been around, as you just said, for thousands of years.
Exactly.
We're the last person going to be unwilling to believe.
Right, exactly. Exactly. I think as you go on this sort of spiritual journey, any person, that flexibility is crucial, because otherwise you just end up in more, you know, you get locked at a certain spot and you can't continue whenever you have rigid
well,
thinking.
Well, that's true. And when there's a, let's say, an opposing point of view, that's a very convincingly stated, then we begin a war of ideas. My idea versus your idea, or, you know, 20 of my ideas versus, you know, a new idea. And our minds are always at war, and that's what we do not want.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Now, with the title of this book, of course, mm-hmm. a very powerful title, The Toltec Art of Life and Death, and Toltec meaning a couple different things. So I'm curious how you would describe it. You know, I've seen where it means a man or woman of knowledge, but of course, also it's an ancient Mexican civilization. Can you explain the context in which you're using it here in the title?
Yeah, Toltec means artist. And the word Toltec is a Nahuatl word that literally does mean artist or artisan. And so the fundamental thing to communicate here about that word is that this was a civilization of artists, not tribes or, mm-hmm. you know, a race of people. It was, you know, I guess you could say Templars or something by European analogies, but they had a certain way of thinking and looking at the world. And out of that was built, you could say, a great thriving community of like thinkers. So yes, they were probably artists in the sense of crafts and agricultures and architectures, but they were artists of their own life or reality.
Fascinating. The art of living.
Yes, exactly.
Can you take a moment for us, for those, of course, who haven't, and we don't want to give away everything about the book, and there's mm-hmm. a lot to it, and it's wonderful, wonderful book. Can you explain the general premise of the book?
Okay, so, you know, Miguel has written 5 or 6 bestsellers, all stating sort of a point of view and using a certain kind of language. Of course, he publishes books in English, so I'm not talking about that kind of language. I'm talking about the way he uses words. Sure. In order to communicate a different point of view or logic. And in this one, he wanted to get much deeper and broader in his teaching, and he decided that we should take it from the point of view of his actual life and the biographical events that make up his life and how we could make a teaching out of all of them, particularly those events that shifted his point of view. These are what he calls throughout the book significant events rather than memorable events. We can be alone, you know, walking in the woods or sitting on the edge of our beds and have a life-changing event. So those things are the kind of thing he was looking for in making up this book about his life. So we take it not exactly in chronological order from
right.
the time of his birth. I asked him, what did he want to do with it? Did he want to do a biography like that? You know, I was born such and such a time, and this is when I graduated. Or would he like to make it a little more, let's say, exciting and put some, you know, put a narrative to it? Well, he liked the idea of a novel. So essentially, that's what this is. And it all takes place within the 9 weeks he was in coma after a heart attack 13 years ago. So how can a story take place in a coma? Well, he's dreaming his life. Your mind is not really functioning, but your brain is always functioning. As long as there's life in you, your brain is functioning. And he did come out of that coma after 9 weeks having, you know, recollecting little bits and pieces of dreams, but we put it together as a compilation of what was actually going on while he was in a coma with his mother doing ceremony, trying to help him to return to life, the doctors helping him return to life, and his own reflections on his existence as a human being.
Wow. Yeah. And that was going to be my next question. Of course, how much of the book, which is all taking place in his psyche while in coma, you know, how much of that is, you know, recollection that is, you know, for example, as we talked about before we started recording, I just interviewed Eben Alexander, who was in a coma for 7 days, and his brain was actually, I mean, the doctors still don't know how he came back. His brain was completely destroyed. There's like, they unplugged him, like, and then he miraculously came back, but he still had these vivid experiences during his you know, coma, which is, of course, what his book was written about. And so, very interesting to me when I kind of done, you know, had these two lined up back to back, synchronistic.
Exactly.
And with something we always talk about, synchronicity on the show. And here it is, the same kind of experience. He's in a coma, except for instead of, you know, a week, it's, you know, 9 weeks in you know, Don's case. So I'm curious how much of that is vivid memory that we're reading, and how much of it is, you know, kind of taking bits and pieces and then adding narrative to it.
No, this is, we're taking a lot of creative license here to tell the story of a man's life, which from Miguel's perspective is a dream. All our lives are being dreamed, whether we're asleep or awake or comatose. You and I are dreaming right now. We're dreaming of a wonderful conversation we're having together. And both of us, each of us, has a different impression about this conversation. Each of us came into the conversation with a different set of circumstances and experiences, and we're going to leave this conversation with a completely different set of circumstances and experiences, because each of us has a completely unique and different way of dreaming because of the way, you know, because of our DNA, and also the because of the way the mind was programmed since the time we learned to speak. And so here we are, we're relating the story of Miguel Ruiz's life. And we're putting together all the significant moments as we think they can apply to his teaching. At the same time, he knows that he was having, you know, if not recollections, he was having impressions. His brain was processing impressions. So all of these things we're using as a creative tool, not only to explain the events of a man's life, but to explain how those teachings related to the events and how they developed into a great wisdom that I think has contributed a lot to the awareness of, you know, people around the world.
Absolutely. Can you share the... you know, one of the things that I loved, and there's a lot that I loved about the book, and what I want to do is just touch on some of the topics and things that were discussed in the book. I'm sure you're going to have some wonderful insight. And one of the things that really struck me was a story that he shared that he kind of says his journey to awareness began with an incredible story of a car crash he had when he was young, when he was an actual a regular, quote unquote, doctor. Can you tell us a little bit about that event?
Yes, he was, an intern at that point in his life. And he and a bunch of friends had gone to another town to have a party. And when they came back, they were happy and drunk and racing back to Mexico City on a wide open road. And at some point, he blacked out. He was driving and ran the car into a partition, a concrete wall. None of them were in any way injured. And when he woke from that experience, coming conscious again in the hospital, he realized that he had little bits and fragmented pieces of memory of keeping his friends safe and protecting his own body. And this raised a lot of questions about, well, what does that mean? Does that mean I'm not the body? Who was it that was keeping these people safe? Who was it that kept me from you know, being crushed in this head-on collision? And after that, you know, medicine became sort of a broader issue for him. It wasn't just about saving lives and operating on somebody's brain. It was about, well, what does the brain do? And how does the mind work? And how do we get these impressions about being something other than our physical body? And eventually that led him to go back to his mother, who was a teacher. And as I said, a healer, curandera, they call it in Spanish. And he said, tell me what you know, what the family knows. This is the first time he had really seriously looked into the wisdom of his shamanic ancestors. And he wanted to see what he could tap into there. Of course, in the course of becoming a shaman himself, he took his own direction and has created his own way of teaching, which he likes to say is common sense. It's not so much about, you know, the miracles and the mysticism that people usually get excited about. It really is. So much of the answers that come to us are just simple common sense, and we've gotten so far away from that.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. I'm certainly guilty of loving the fantastical kind of magical stories.
There was a lot of that in his life growing up because he was around magical people and had them in his family. But, you know, I think the really great thing that we can all, the gift we can give ourselves is realizing that magic is every single moment. And because things are familiar does not mean they're not magical and miraculous.
Absolutely. And I think the more magic you can see in the everyday stuff of life, the more, you know, magic appears where you have these, you know, otherwise unexplainable kind of circumstances that many people on this path have had here or there. And I think it's one of those things. And it seems like he's very careful not to get too caught up on, you know, being wowed by that or being wowed by your own knowledge or being wowed by anything, you know, just moving to a place of calmness and acceptance for what is. And I think that is very powerful and simple perspective on how to live your life.
Yes.
Now, speaking of those magical stories, though, just a bit more. So with the car crash, you know, he talks about, and I'll let people read to get all the details. It's definitely a fun story where he, you know, it's kind of like the typical, you hear time standing still, where he actually is observing outside of his body, watching himself and helping his friends to get out of harm's way before the crash and in this sort of altered state. In another magical story that was in the book that really stuck out was the story of his aunt at one time when he was a kid having a big impact on him. Can you recount that story?
Yes, and understand this is from the perspective of a child, but they're all outside the house having dinner at a big table, lots of relatives. As you can imagine, he's a 13th child of a couple. And so at one point, his aunt turns to him at the table and says, could you go in and get a bowl? And he goes into the kitchen, and the same aunt is sitting there at the sink. And she asks him, what do you need? And he goes, a bowl.
told me to come in here to get the bowl, and you're here and watching.
She gives him one and sends him back, and she's sitting at the table. So, you know, he can tell so many stories of the weirdness of growing up in a bunch of, in a family full of, you could say, tricksters or mind benders. And he thought that was very normal at the time. You know, we're not so much in the business of wanting to freak people out or, you know, shock them or make them feel like they're out of control of their own realities. In fact, quite the opposite. We are in control, and we perform miracles and powers of suggestion all the time. You know, we persuade people to our own way of thinking all the time. So in a sense, you could say everybody's a sorcerer, and every mind is a trickster.
Yeah, absolutely. I definitely can see that. In the book, he took many of his followers. It recounted, you know, these trips where he took many of his followers to the ancient ruins. And hopefully I'm pronouncing it right. Teotihuacan.
Okay, it's Teotihuacan.
I tried.
It's so close. It's a complicated looking word, but over time it's pretty easy. And what's interesting is that it's such a, I think, global secret. It's a fantastic spot. Very impressive pyramids and ruins right there in central Mexico, very near Mexico City. So it's worth visiting regardless of whether you are interested in Toltec lore or not.
Right. And so you attended some of those trips, assuming?
I not only attended them over and over again every year, but I started bringing groups myself for years and years. I was doing that too.
What kind of things would you do when you're down there? You could give a little glimpse into that.
The pyramids are sort of enclosed in a national, you could say, park or historical site. And I don't know how many of the original structures have been unearthed at this point, whether it's just a little bit or a lot. But what they have revealed over the last half a century is quite an impressive, you could say, city. You know, with a long avenue running up the center of it. And on either side of the avenue are the ruins now of temples and plazas and a pyramid that's huge called the Pyramid of the Sun and one that is slightly less huge called the Pyramid of the Moon. And so what I'm describing just very briefly is a map. And what we do when we go down there is follow that map from one end of the avenue to the next, and to the opposite end, and typically we would do ceremonies or have conversations or send people out on little quests from plaza to plaza, temple to temple, and ultimately end at the Pyramid of the Sun. After days of that kind of intensive, you could say, learning. Mm-hmm. End up at the top of the Pyramid of the Sun for a final ceremony. How any teacher does it at any one time is up to them. And right. I used to take great joy in doing it differently every time. So mainly it's a great, inspiring place to get people's attention and to offer them ideas and guidance that they themselves can sort out and process at their own pace.
Very, very interesting. Now, do you still lead those trips, or does he still lead those trips?
He will join his sons from time to time in those trips. I don't do it much. I haven't, let's say, in the last couple of years. And I think the reason is we're getting old. It's a lot of walking every day and climbing and a lot of sun. And I have classes where I live in L.A. I have had classes for many years in San Diego and in Las Vegas and in Phoenix. So I continue to teach. And when I get a group in the mood to go, I will go.
Very, very interesting. It sounds like a very fun trip. So if you ever plan to go again, drop me an email because that sounds like a great place to go.
Well, it's like the spot is unlike almost anything you can find in the world. Yeah. Yes, the Egyptians have pyramids and the Mayans and the Incas, but this is pretty amazing. And the Toltec as a community were kind of mysterious because archaeologists can't quite put their, put the information into some kind of context, what they were, why they were, and where they went.
Yeah. Now is Miguel's lineage is traced back, though, to Toltec?
To Aztec, you could say, which followed the Toltec civilization. Okay. The Toltec civilization had come and gone by the time, the Aztec had started ruling in that area. So, they go back to Aztec warriors, which are, you could say, actual warriors, military, or you could say, like the Toltecs, spiritual warriors. They're main focus was the mind and, you know, the war of ideas that I, as I had mentioned earlier, something we want to win over.
Yeah. Now, his mother, Don's mother, who's referred to Sarita in the book, is throughout the book, she is in, you know, the waking world, but yet in a trance, interacting with her son in a coma, trying to kind of lure him back to the physical world, and he's reluctant to go back. And so a lot of the book is going through that sort of experience. Was that something that she was actively doing at the time?
She was
actually going into trance and trying to bring him out of the coma.
She was doing ceremonies with her family and her close students every night.
Wow.
Every night. And they were doing, you know, different rituals and mostly just praying together. But there was, you know, there was whatever she thought would help in terms of, you know, drumming and calling on the ancestors and the trance state and things like that. She had her own way of doing things. Let's put it that way. And so to extend that reality a little, we created in the narrative her actual a presence in his dream.
Right, right.
And, you know, which you could say was the ultimate goal of performing all these ceremonies, that she can talk to him directly. You can't talk to the person lying in CCU or ICU or
right.
whatever.
Right.
But she could approach it from another point of view. So there it is. She finds him in his own dream, which is now very separated from the rest of reality. And she tries to persuade him. He gives a very logical argument. You know, I've got a body that's broken. Essentially, yeah. That this heart is so damaged, it won't be worth coming back to. And
right.
But of course, he also knows that the doctors are doing their best, and they're some of the best doctors, certainly in California. So, you know, they have that little back and forth, and he finally just sends her on a sort of mission to gather up the memories of his life, just as a way of sort of keeping her busy and maybe informing her about his point of view and his life. And maybe she can see that he accomplished what he wanted to accomplish, regardless of her point of view.
Right. Now, obviously, mother always wins. A mother always knows best, because he is back here with us after 9 weeks in that coma. And
yes,
so whatever
and
she was doing.
Years, right.
Wow. And how is his health? He had made a full recovery from that.
No, he did not. There was no recovering, really, because the heart was so badly damaged. But several years later, he was able to receive a heart transplant, and that made a huge difference. Yeah, he received one in 2009, I think.
Wow, incredible! What an experience.
Yeah, but they actually, when he came out of the coma, they gave him possibly a year to live and said, whatever you do, don't move, sit on a couch and watch TV. And he did none of those things. He said he would rather go out like a warrior, and and he started teaching and traveling again. And after a while, they decided, okay, this guy's not going to die. I guess we better see if we get him a new heart.
Well, how fascinating. What an inspiration.
Uh-huh.
Now, in the book, Layla is a character that represents knowledge. Can you tell us a little about this important character in the symbology that she plays?
Okay, it's Lala.
Okay, of course, I'm messing up the pronunciation again.
No, that's okay.
Sorry.
That's okay. It's just a plain Lala, because she likes to call herself, you know, La Vida, La Diosa, a bunch of things. And so Sarita decides to just cut to the chase and call her Lala. And and she does represent Miguel's knowledge. So Miguel sends Sarita essentially to this character and says she'll put together the image of Miguel that you want to come back to you. The body's, you know, pretty much done for, but, you know, see if you can, on the outside chance that this body lives, see if you can put together Miguel, which is the sum total of, you know, all our experiences and what we think we know and what we think we've learned over a lifetime. And so knowledge takes charge of the quest. And this is very important metaphor, because knowledge is, it tends to be in charge of our realities anyway. And once again, I'm talking about what we think we know about ourselves and about everything around us. It's not just knowledge as you go get from college or from CNN. It's all our, accumulated understanding of the way things work and how we relate to words in general, symbols in general, words, numbers, drawings, gestures, everything. And knowledge creates our reality. It tells us what is and is not real, what is right, what is wrong, what is good, what is bad. And knowledge is not us. We're conducting our lives as if we thought knowledge was us, but it's not. The body is not us. What we are is life itself, which makes body and mind possible. And this is eventually, you know, what we all have to come to grips with, that we're not knowledge and we don't need to keep constantly represent our knowledge in order to define ourselves. Right. Our presence is much more of an indicator about the truth of us. Our presence, what we are when we're most authentic and have nothing really to say, to believe in, to pitch to the world.
Yeah, that is very powerful, very powerfully said. And of course, you talk about your teaching using knowledge to transcend knowledge, mm-hmm. which I think is a very fascinating concept, because it's kind of the jumping off point, right?
Right. Well, you and I right now, you can say each of us is knowledge talking. And so we have to use these words, these ideas, these perspectives that were derived from ideas and beliefs in order to convince or unconvince ourselves of what it is we know. So knowledge literally is the biggest problem we have, and it's the only salvation. With it, we can turn ourselves away from depending on, identity and belief systems, and have complete faith in what we truly are, which is this force of life that moves matter. And I think he makes that very clear in the book too, that matter and energy are the only truth there is.
Yeah, he talks about, you know, knowledge cannot take us to true seeing, and, you know, even refers to it, you know, knowledge is a distortion of truth. And Lala was even at one point referred to as a demon because it possesses us, which I thought was a very interesting way to kind of put it.
Well, angels can possess us too. And are we going to let knowledge, be the menace, the tyrant? And put us into fear and anger and disharmony with other humans and ourselves all the time? Or are we going to let knowledge lift us and inspire us and ultimately put us on the path of creation, not destruction? And each of us has to determine that. I'm not talking about a global perspective. I'm talking about the minds of each human being.
What is the way that you would, you know... I mean, he talks about relieving himself of beliefs and expectations, mm-hmm. is sort of what we're touching on, in order to expand awareness. Mm-hmm. How do you think, what are your recommendations how to start down that journey, start down that path?
Well, don't believe yourself or anybody else.
Right.
That would be the first one. That's the fifth agreement. Be skeptical, but listen. And listening is a very, very important part of our interaction with anything and anybody. Let's find out whatever we can find out from how people talk, what they do, how we talk, how we think. Let's get the information we need about who's in charge of our own realities. And then we can make modifications. But if we're so determined not only to believe everything that we say and think, and then project those beliefs onto other people, then we can't really move towards awareness.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said. In the book, you guys talk about the difference between intent and intention. And I found that really interesting because I often talk about intent or intention and the differentiation between the two. Can you explain that?
Yes. Intention is what the mind does. You know, it decides, well, it's my intention to, you know, have lunch with Brandon tomorrow, or it's my intention to become a world-class athlete. This is the mind's determination. Intent is really, you could say, the will of life. And when we're in harmony or surrendered to that will, we're not helpless. In fact, we're much, much stronger and more powerful than we thought we could be simply by having a clever mind and a lot of goals and purposes.
Yeah.
This doesn't mean we don't know how to get up and brush our teeth and go out into the world and succeed in business. It means that we are flexible. We're not stuck to a certain outcome or expectation. And we realize not only is life in charge, but we are life underneath all that, you know, all those ideas and those beliefs and all those arguments about, you know, who we are as identities. We are life. And looking at it from that perspective, it's obvious that we can surrender to that. We're not surrendering to any other entity. We're surrendering to the truth of ourselves.
Yeah. And I often kind of express when talking about intention, you know, what is whenever you're doing any kind of activity or you're setting out into the world to make a difference or mm-hmm. interact or mix it up with people, what is the underlying intent? You know, and the intention is to have lunch. The intent is to actually share knowledge or give, you know, a loving, positive experience with another being.
Well, and I think our intent is to be there. Just, yeah. You know, be there. Don't, you know, put up a bunch of obstacles. You know, I've got to make my point. I've got to win my argument. Let's just be there. And that's what life does. It's just there, whether we want it or not. And it will be there forever. And it has been there forever. We come and go as minds, as bodies. But life is everlasting. And that is the truth of us.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I would say, you know, based off of the underlying oneness of all things, when you go into any interaction with an intent to, you know, to leave it better than you found it, or just to, you know, share that love, you can expect that to come back your way, as opposed to, you know, you have so many people out there whose intent is to deceive or to, you know, get something, as opposed to maybe offer or give of themselves in some way. And I think, of course, that's just from a distorted perspective. And I think it's just, for me, it's a really powerful thing to always check in with. What is my intent with what I'm doing? What is the underlying motivation? And I've found, as I've, you know, over the years in my own growth and learning through the School of Hard Knocks, that the more I can get that underlying intent in a pure place, the more smooth and peaceful type of experience that I have.
Right. That means you're on the same page with life.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So now he also talks about humanity being addicted to suffering. Can you expand a little bit on that idea?
Well, we think of, you know, this day and age, we talk about addictions all the time. And and they get more and more numerous as we talk about them. And his point is that there is only one. There's only one addiction: making yourself miserable or making yourself uncomfortable or suffering in some way. It may be a little bit of suffering, like feeling, you know, sort of mildly guilty. Or, you know, it could be dynamic suffering. But aside from outside circumstances, which shouldn't make you suffer, obviously our body suffers through deprivation. Aside from all of that, the mind only has one appetite or addiction, and that's, you know, how to make the body less comfortable than it needs to be. So how do you do that? Well, you drink too much, or you lie too much, or you gamble, or you do this or that or the other, or you eat too much, or you don't eat enough. And all of this comes down to the same result. We're suffering. we're miserable. And we need to check on our appetite for even small sufferings and see why does everything I do lead to this same result? It's not so much about the drinking and the smoking and the this and the that. It's about, why am I not committed to my own happiness and well-being? And you know, from that point of view, it's I think, a liberating thing. Okay, the only thing I have to worry about is making myself unhappy. And I don't want that addiction. I don't want it. So everything that makes that addiction possible has to go.
Yeah. Yeah, I love one point where he says, you know, we are love. When we stop pretending we're anything else, we've gained our authenticity. And of course, being authentic is the whole goal. I mean, suffering is going to fall away as a natural byproduct of that, right?
Yes. When we are committed to our human, as we like to say, then so many things become unnecessary and irrelevant. And we see also that we're being less than impeccable, and impeccable means without sin. And the only sin that Miguel really articulates is going against yourself, going against your human. And we can do that in so many subtle and discreet ways. And it's really important to listen, to look, and to see what our favorite ways are so we can modify them.
Yeah, yeah. And one of the issues, or he references, that I thought was really, really cool too, is he talks about the consequences of domestication. Would you explain what he means by that?
Well, of course, we're domesticated. We're domesticated by those who take care of us from the time we are born. And that means not only, you know, potty training and things like that, but they share with us their knowledge. They share their points of view about life. They share their beliefs. Not only do they structure our reality, our days, our nights, but they give the mind structure. There is no mind until we learn a language and until we start communicating with other people and eventually ourselves. So the domestication of the mind is, you know, the whole belief structure as taught to us by our caretakers and our teachers throughout our lifetime. This is neither a good thing nor a bad thing. It's an inevitable and inescapable thing. But at 20, 30, 50, 80 years old, we shouldn't be the victims of our domestication. We should have, you know, seen what works for us and doesn't work for us in terms of belief, what makes our dream happy or not happy, and what ultimately we want to say about ourselves beyond the things that have been said about us for a lifetime.
Right. Or the things that are being kind of force fed. I saw, it makes me think of something that I just saw recently. It was a clip where someone had taken the 6 o'clock news, let's call it. And it was just from all over the country. And it was different news anchors saying the exact same scripted kind of joke. It was like verbatim, you know, it was maybe a 15 second riff. Yeah. And it's like, if you have any questions about whether or not you're being force fed, perspectives, you won't have that question anymore when you see 25 news anchors from across the country saying the exact same words, you know, in the same delivery. And it's something that really gets you thinking about, you know, of course, everything being vibration, and we're vibrational beings and everything is energy and vibration. And then so many people are tuned into this box that's pumping this certain perspective at you. That's kind of what came to mind when I thought about being domesticated versus, you know, the opposite of going to explore these pyramids and having these, you know, great experiences where your actually intent is to expand your awareness in a way that is maybe outside the box of what is quote unquote culturally normal. Mm-hmm. And so I think, yeah, that's just something that kind of comes to mind when I think of him talking about the consequences of domestication, maybe in a negative way in that particular instance. And as you said, it's neither good nor bad, because there's certain parts of it that are very necessary.
Well,
we
have to be domesticated, or we don't have a chance being, you know, a human. We're so vulnerable when we're born, and we're so, you know, in need of guidance as children. But By the time we're adults, we can take over our own domestication and we can do it with impeccability.
Yes, yes. And, you know, there's a couple parts in the book where he talks about, he uses kind of these statements that seem such a trademark of a profound teacher, and you know, he injects a bit of comedy as well, where he asks, you know, I think it's Dara in the book, where he says, yes, you know, are you happy or are you stupid? Uh-huh. And right. I thought, you know, and then also there's another one. He's asking people, are you a honey eater or a poo eater, which of course, right, you know, makes you laugh. Tell me a little bit about that, what he means with those two statements.
Okay, are you happy or are you stupid? Always gets a reaction out of people. You know, it's like these things are not in any way related. But when you think of happiness as a choice, not something inflicted on you, given to you, or unhappiness inflicted on you, it's a choice. Heaven is your particular state of mind. It's the way you see reality. If you see reality in a pleasurable way, it's heaven. If you see it in a unpleasant or a cause for suffering, then it's hell. So happiness is your state of mind, how comfortable you are with yourself, your human, and the reality that you live in. And it's therefore a choice. If you make the choice to be unhappy, that sounds stupid to him.
Right.
So that's the sort of trajectory there. You're happy. Happiness is a choice. You're unhappy. Happiness is a choice. So why are you choosing unhappiness? Well, of course, we don't think it's a choice. We think it's been, you know, somehow, you know, that unhappiness and misery has been inflicted on us because of, you know, so-and-so, or because of this situation, or because of, you know, the circumstances of our birth or our lineage or heritage or whatever. You know, we inherited. I've known people say, you know, they come from a long line of I don't know, relatives that came out of starvation or the depression, and therefore they're miserable. But you know, what is your situation right now? That's the only thing that matters. Suffering is not in your DNA. It's not in your relative's DNA. It's a matter of point of view and perspective, and how good your relationship is with yourself and with life in general. So are you happy or are you stupid makes perfect sense in that sense. And the thing about bees and flies and honey and poo, I think, is so simple and so marvelous, because we tend to eat information that makes us unhappy. We tend to consume information that puts us on edge or creates fear. You know, it's part of that whole addiction thing. So if you're eating poison, or let's say poo in this childish analogy, then you're doing it on purpose. Why are you doing it? Because there's plenty of honey around. There's plenty of good, inspiring, and uplifting information. Knowledge is either serving you or it's working against your happiness. And you are in charge of knowledge. In fact, you are knowledge until you realize you're more, you're beyond knowledge, you're life itself. So are you eating honey or are you eating poo? That tells you a lot about whether you're a bee or a fly. And we don't want to be flies. I mean, flies are lovely. I'm sure they have a purpose, but you know, they're not looking for the kind of food that we want to, you know, we want to be consuming. Miguel used to put us all on fasts at Lent, or, you know, before a journey or something. And it wasn't a fast of the body. It wasn't about food and what we ingest. It was about the ideas we are consuming and believing in. And his discipline for us was to see what we were eating mentally, mm-hmm, and to modify that diet.
Mm-hmm. Well, it makes me think of, you know, one of the things that was said that I thought was really profound. Unhappiness is the natural result of having rigid and principled opinions. So the more rigid you get with your ideas of right and wrong and expectation and all those things, the more miserable you are. And as a result, you know, you're eating poo.
Well, and, you're disappointed all the time because your expectations aren't being met. You're at war with yourself because your ideas are in conflict with other ideas or other people's ideas. And we're constantly in alarm, you could say physically, neurologically in some kind of state of alarm. And that results in, you know, an unpleasant experience of life. That's not what we're here to do, to make life unpleasant. And we do have a choice. No matter the circumstance, we do have a choice.
Now, in the book, he's referred to as hopefully I get the pronunciation, a Nagual man?
Nawal. Yeah, Nawal.
Okay, I missed again. One day, Barbara, I'm going to get it right chance.
This is another language. It's like, you know, trying to learn, I don't know, Sudanese or something. So Nawal, is the person, usually, obviously, a wise man, but the person who knows himself as life. You know, when we think of ourselves as just human, just mind, we're trapped within a certain bubble of perception, then they had a word for that too, which was tonal. You are, in other words, you identify yourself as matter, not as the thing that moves matter, which is life itself.
Interesting. And another great analogy that he's given when in the book, he's actually interacting with his sons when they're young. And he talks about life being a game. You know, we're the toy. And if we don't know the rules, we can't advance to the next level. I think they're actually playing Super Mario Brothers
Super Mario,
or something.
Right.
Yeah. What do you think he meant by that?
Well, let's take it once again from the point of view that reality is virtual. What we think of as reality is virtual. So typical of human beings that, you know, recreate everything they perceive in some way or another, we have recreated the virtual reality that we are, through the impressions we get of, you know, light and matter hitting the brain. The brain interprets, and then the mind reinterprets through language. So all of this becomes quite virtual. And yet we think, you know, our thoughts, our worries, our ideas are absolutely real and connected to something real. We created video games in this century, sort of typically, as I say, because we recreate everything about our world and try to make it better. We created video games, which is a beautiful, not just a metaphor, but a reflection on what our reality actually is. You could say we are the avatars in our own reality, personal reality. Yeah. We create that main character. We create that toy. The toy is the human, and the human has a mind, and it's out there in the world trying to succeed or, you know, escape goblins or whatever it's doing. Yeah. And that's exactly what the little character of Super Mario was. Of course, we're relating in that story to whatever, the 80s or 90s, when that was about the only video game around.
Yeah,
and
right.
So, you know, we could go into something a lot more sophisticated now, and the graphics are very real too. But
right.
The idea is the same. You create the central character, and this central character you play with at different levels of comprehension until you can succeed at the game. And we design this character to be, you know, a loser or a winner or, you know, a beauty queen or whatever it is. And then we go out into the world and see what it can do. Know what this character is capable of. Know its limitations. And then, you know, go to this level and that level and the other level of awareness. That's essentially the way we're doing our own personal realities.
Yeah, I love the comparison of a video game and often use it myself, talking about, you know, the idea or concept that we're in the eternal moment of now. Time is an illusion. And as a result, all these potential potential versions of self have already played out. You know, there's the version of, you know, my fifth birthday is happening on another channel essentially right now. I'm just not tuned into it. And that goes for the future as well. We've already done what we're going to do from this moment forward. And it's like a game. And it's kind of where I always like to say it's where free will meets destiny, because much like a game, what version of you you're going to see next depends on the choices that you're making, right? It's all already happened. It's all already programmed into the game in, you know, that eternal moment of now, but you get to choose again which version you want to see. And so I really resonated strongly with his using of a, you know, game comparison like you did.
Yeah.
Well, what's next for you? I mean, you know, obviously this is such an incredible experience. I'm sure to be able to partner up with Don Miguel Ruiz and, you know, of course, use your own voice in the process. And is there any forthcoming book that, I know you just released this one, but
we did, but we're already working on the next one. So,
Cool.
There will be more. There was, you know, kind of a drought for a while there. In between Miguel's publications, and I think this collaboration works well. We can just keep going and do things in different ways and deliver messages in so many wonderful and entertaining styles.
Yeah. Okay. Well, is there any kind of sneak peek into what that will look like, or is it too early to tell?
You know, this is going to be like... It's not going to be fictionalized or novelized like this last one. It's going to be a self-help book, but I can say it's going to get really down to the absolute most profound level of this teaching, and that's pretty exciting for both of us.
Yeah, excellent. Well, I can't wait to see what that is. I can't wait to check it out. What is the best place for people? I'm sure they can find it at their local bookstore or online. Where would you recommend someone to pick up the Toltec Art of Life and Death?
Well, it's on Amazon, of course, Barnes & Noble, yeah. Of course, yep. And Barnes & Noble has it in all their stores. And of course, anybody can order it from a local bookstore.
Okay.
I believe the audiobook is out, which is sensational. And it's you can find this book anywhere. Whether they're promoting it or not, it's there.
Okay. Ready? Yeah, I figured as much. But just in case there was a particular place you wanted to direct them to, I thought I would ask.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And one question that I always love to ask Barbara, my guest, it's sort of a staple on the show, is you know, being fascinated with the ideas of synchronicity or serendipity or a positive paranormal event. We've touched on a few, you know, in Don's life. Is there any sort of story of synchronicity that you'd care to share?
Well, as I said before, I think, you know, I learned over the years that all synchronicity and miraculous events are, you know, typical, normal. They're what's happening all the time. We get a little complacent about the, you know, the miracles that are coming at us all the time, because so many of them look mundane. And, you know, every day, the fact that we're breathing is rather a phenomenal miracle.
Absolutely.
But I can say that when I was at my most troubled and lost and didn't think I knew anything and the rest of the world knew everything, I was guided to a yoga teacher, a Sikh woman, who the first day, the first session, put us all in what she called beggar's pose, where you look down at your cupped hands and you just focus on the thing you want most. And in my abject state, I couldn't think of anything. And so I said, you know, I'd like a guide. I just wanted somebody who knew something, who was willing to spend the time to share that understanding with me. And within a few short months, somebody introduced me to Miguel Ruiz. So our relationship, as I said, has been so not only long-term, but so harmonious. I'm sure I was a troubling apprentice at first. I'm sure I created a lot of problems and made a lot of noise, but so much of that is hard to remember now, because life is only a miracle to me. And of course, that in itself, the meeting was a great miracle and a gift. And maybe I didn't need to state it, but I think it's important that we all admit to ourselves what it is we really want, even if it's, you know, a car or a toy or, you know, a picket fence somewhere. We need to admit what we really want, state it, and put our life force into receiving it. Not just, you know, going out and finding it, but being able to receive it, loving ourselves enough to give ourselves that grace. We forget that it isn't just about, you know, begging and pleading and getting something from life, but it's also about opening up and receiving it, regardless of how it looks and how it comes. So that's it. So many things have happened to me in wonderful and miraculous ways because I finally just say, this is what I want.
Right. Well, you may have been an agitating apprentice in the early days, but I'm sure he is counting his blessings now because you did an absolutely phenomenal job co-authoring this book with him. And it doesn't surprise me at all that he's coming back for more co-authoring, you know, journeys with you because it's excellent. I highly recommend everyone picking up the Toltec Art of Life and Death. And before I let you go here, Barbara, this has been so fascinating. I do want to leave you with one stumping, put you on the spot question. Okay, you ready for this?
Yeah.
What is the meaning of life according to Barbara Emrys?
Well, life doesn't require a meaning. I am life. I'm here and I'm dealing with it. Life is self-explanatory and needs no justification.
Love that answer. That is the perfect answer to someone who's using knowledge to transcend knowledge. Thank you so much again for taking the time to do this. We will be paying close attention to the next iteration of your work together. Okay. And until our paths cross, journey well.
Okay. Thank you so much. You too. Bye-bye.
Well, everyone, that concludes this week's interview episode. If you have enjoyed this positive download from our hearts and minds to yours, please take a minute, give us a rating or review on iTunes. Since iTunes is the holy grail of all things podcasting, your good reviews help us to reach more listeners. Also, we would be extremely appreciative if you would tell your friends and family about the show. Our sincere intent with the Positive Head podcast is to spread positivity to the world. Because we're selfish, quite honestly. I say that jokingly, but really only halfway joking. I'm referring to the good kind of selfish based on the knowing that we all get what we give in this life, because when we give, we're actually always giving to extensions of self, since we're all really one in the same consciousness, just in different bodies. So if you want to be a good selfish along with us by helping to spread the positivity, by all means, please proceed to shout about the Positive Head podcast from your rooftop. Otherwise, as you continue on your fabulous journey in this 3D reality, be sure to remember this. As long as you ain't dead, you're already positive ahead. Journey well, everyone, and thank you for being.
America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. To serve others in ways that promote human flourishing and create a ripple effect of transformation for generations to come. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.